Good morning, everyone. My name is Sarah, and I'll be the conference operator today. At this time, I'd like to welcome you all to the Chemical Disaster Prevention by EPA conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. I'd now like to turn the call over to our host, Mr. Rick Hines. You may begin your conference.
Thank you. My name is Rick Hines. I'm the Legislative Director of Greenpeace, and I want to just briefly introduce the speakers today who will talk about the fact that 10 years ago this week, the White House under President Bush planned to roll out a chemical disaster prevention policy. And we have with us today Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who was administrator of the EPA at that time, who oversaw the creation of that policy. She will be followed by Bob Bostock, who is a Homeland Security Advisor at EPA to Administrator Whitman. And then following Bob will be Mike Wright from the United Steelworkers, who was on the International Investigative Team in Bhopal and is also the Director of Health, Safety, and Environment for the United Steelworkers. Following Mike will be Richard Moore, who is an environment, was the first chair of the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, which is a FACA to EPA on environmental justice. And he works with many endangered communities around this issue and is director of the Los Jardines Institute in Albuquerque. Then I will make a few comments, and we will also have available several experts by phone, and they include Paul Oram, who's written four reports for the Center for American Progress on chemical hazards and safer alternatives, Scott Nelson, an attorney with Public Citizens Litigation Group, who drafted a legal analysis of EPA's significant authority on this issue currently, Ed Schlegel, a retired Los Angeles fire captain who has spoken out on the need for this to protect communities, and also the first responders who actually come into chemical disasters, and Michelle Roberts from Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, who's worked with many communities around the country who are threatened by the hazardous chemical facilities and the poison gases that they store. So with that, we'll let Governor Whitman start us off this morning. Welcome.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You know, this is an issue that I find just enormously frustrating and very, very troubling. After 9/11, we had bipartisan support for trying to deal with this issue. We moved immediately, if you'll remember, and Congress moved immediately to protect water sources. There was no problem with that. We worked with the industry. We got guidelines in place. We found money to help them meet the criteria that were established. But with the Chemistry Council, we started meeting with them right away, understanding, of course, the importance of this and the enormous vulnerability we have. And the council itself took some action. They put in place some protocols that they wanted their members to which they should adhere. We took that language. We took that language and put it into the form of legislation because that's how we thought it would be the best way to move forward. That would give the most certainty to the companies, and it would start to address this issue of what do we do to protect our chemical sites, understanding the enormous impact that anything that happens at one of those facilities can have. I mean, people talk to me about their fears of nuclear, let's say, after Fukushima Daiichi, and I say, when was the last time you heard of a problem there? Think of what happens when you have how many times have we heard of a truck carrying chemicals spilling and you've had to evacuate whole communities? Just imagine what happens if a terrorist were to target these facilities. There are other chemicals that can be used, but the industry needs some certainty. It needs some focus. And we thought we were on the right track because, to me, the argument was logical. If the Chemistry Council was requiring their members to upgrade their facilities, their security, to harden their targets, and to look for alternative chemicals, they only have a a portion of the chemical facilities out there. Why wouldn't they want everyone to have to spend money and to have to focus on this? Because if something happens at any chemical facility, the entire industry is going to get blamed for it, and you're going to see an enormous pushback. Unfortunately, as I think you've all seen, heard, and read over time, we got frustrated in that. I was working very closely with Tom Ridge at the Department of Homeland Security to put legislation together. I decided we couldn't do that. We looked at using the general duty clause at that point, but again, there was no appetite at the White House for doing that. They felt, and I don't disagree with them, that a far better way that did offer more certainty would be legislative action, but we could not get the Hill to act. The chemistry industry in and of itself was just too strong, and they felt that any kind of action on the part of the agency or on the Hill taking action to regulate what was going on was just the beginning of a downward spiral. I would maintain it would make them more competitive. It would, more importantly, it would protect the lives of our citizens. And so this has been an ongoing battle that we've been having these 10 years. And it just, to me, I don't understand. I cannot get my mind around why we haven't seen some action when the consequences of something happening at a chemical facility are just so potentially devastating. I'll stop there. I'll be happy to answer questions later on. It's not so much the history at this point to me that's important. It is what it is. But what we need to have is some action now. And I believe that EPA does have the ability under the General Duty Clause and other parts of their regulatory authority to start to require some actions by chemical facilities in general and across the country, and we all would be a whole lot better off if they started to act that way.
Great. Okay. And Bob, you were Homeland Security Advisor at the EPA at that time.
Yes, thank you, Rick. I went back and checked, and it's exactly 10 years ago today that Governor Whitman was sitting in a front row at a ceremony in the Rose Garden. I was standing in the back as the President signed the Bioterrorism Act of 2002, which gave EPA significant responsibility and authority for the nation's drinking water systems in reducing their vulnerability to terrorist attack. This same week, 10 years ago, we were ready to roll out the beginnings of a plan to reduce the vulnerabilities of the facilities that had the greatest amount of potentially hazardous chemicals that could be potentially used to in a terrorist attack to affect large amounts of people. We had a plan ready to go, but the White House Office of Homeland Security, and as Governor Whitman said, you know, we don't necessarily disagree, felt that if we did roll out this plan using the General Duty Clause at that time, we'd undoubtedly find ourselves in court very quickly, litigating whether the authority under the General Duty Clause would extend to this issue. So we immediately went into working with the Office of Homeland Security and other federal departments and agencies that would have jurisdiction over some of these areas to draft legislation. We had a great deal of optimism at the time that we'd be able to get this done through the legislative process because Congress was working very effectively and very quickly addressing some of the major concerns that existed at that time, airports, bioterrorism, as that bill that was signed 10 years ago, other areas. So it was very frustrating for us at the end of the day not to be able to move forward legislation and not to be able to use the General Duty Clause in lieu of legislation. So I would just say that 10 years after those efforts, it's enormously frustrating, as Governor Whitman said, to see that this is still a sector that is very much in need of some good, firm action by the federal government to make sure that all of the facilities that have a potential for being used as a terrorist target to sicken and kill thousands of people are that the vulnerabilities of those facilities are reduced and that the American people can have the confidence that the federal government has done what it can to reduce the vulnerabilities of those facilities. We all have learned over the last 10 or more years that the terrorists will tend to look for the easiest targets, the lowest hanging fruit if you will. By reducing the vulnerabilities of our chemical facilities to a terrorist attack, we would, I think, take that off of their list of things to do. They would find something that was easier to accomplish. That was our goal 10 years ago, and I think it remains a goal that still needs to be addressed. And we certainly hope that the EPA will look at this very carefully and that Administrator Jackson will consider using the General Duty Clause to take the sorts of steps that we were trying to accomplish 10 years ago. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Bob. Mike?
Hi, this is Mike Wright from the Steelworkers. We are called the Steelworkers Union for short, but we have a much longer name that I won't bore you with. The important thing for this call is that we represent the majority of unionized workers in the chemical industry and the majority of really all workers who work in oil refineries. We represent about 75% of U.S. refining capacity. So we are very familiar with this industry. Rick, when he introduced me, said that I had been on a team that investigated the Bhopal accident, and that's true. You can't go to a place like Bhopal after an accident like that and not have it affect the way you think about these issues for the rest of your life. I still wake up at night sometimes seeing the faces of people who survived, kids who lost their parents, parents who lost their kids. One of the things that those of us from the U.S. learned on that trip or realized on that trip was that had that plant operated in the United States, none of the things that caused the accident, none of the root causes, would have violated any OSHA or EPA or any other kind of regulation. Everything that that company did that led to the accident would have been perfectly legal. Happily, that's no longer the case. We have some laws in place. We have the OSHA process safety standard. We have the EPA risk management program. Both of those things essentially require companies to do what they can to make their existing processes safer. But there is nothing in federal law that addresses the possibility of having safer processes to begin with, of replacing dangerous ways of making chemicals with safer ways of making chemicals, of replacing dangerous chemicals with safer ones. Even where there are tried and true methods for doing that. And we know from working in this industry that there are chemicals, there are processes, there are potential accidents that could kill not thousands of people as in Bhopal, but literally hundreds of thousands of people. EPA has a list of facilities where a major release would affect more than a million people. It's a long list. Affect means either very seriously injure or kill if they were not able to evacuate in time. And how do you evacuate in time from a place like Houston or Philadelphia or a major city? We investigate accidents in this industry every day. Most of them are things that may kill a worker, may not injure anybody, but breaches several lines of defense. We know how close we have come in some cases to accidents where every line of defense was breached except the last one, and had that last line of defense been breached, we would have been looking at a major catastrophe of the scale of Bhopal. We see that stuff every day. We have a fire or a release of a dangerous chemical in an oil refinery once a week in this country, once a week on average. Again, those things don't get outside the plant gate mostly, but the potential is there. And eventually, unless we address this issue, one of them will. We're going to hear a lot of claims from the chemical industry as this moves forward. They're going to say that EPA has no expertise to look at technology. But when EPA writes a regulation, for example, for maximum achievable control technology under the air pollution statutes, EPA deals with technology all of the time for routine releases of various pollutants. They can certainly have the expertise to deal with this one. They'll claim the government should stay out of regulating these kind of plants, but the government regulates nuclear plants, and some of these kinds of releases in chemical plants could be as bad as a full nuclear meltdown. I don't know of any industry where the gap between the industry safety programs and the potential for a catastrophic accident is so great. That's not to say that the safety programs are so bad. It's just to say that that they're routine, the kind of safety programs you find in the rest of industry, whereas the potential for death and destruction in a major release is so much greater than in a steel plant or a paper mill or some other kind of industrial workplace. The industry is going to say that regulation is going to destroy the industry, and we work in the industry. We depend on the industry. Our jobs depend on the industry. We wouldn't support this kind of thing if we thought that regulation would destroy the industry. We think regulation is going to save the industry. We think that if there is a catastrophic accident in an oil refinery or a chemical plant, the industry will be in very, very serious economic trouble. That's part of what we're trying to prevent. Of course, the major issue is the loss of life. But for the economic health of the industry, we think we need to do this kind of thing. This is part